Macmillan Audio presents Heretics of Dune by Frank Herbert. Read for you by Simon Vance.
Most discipline is hidden discipline, designed not to liberate, but to limit. Do not ask why. Be cautious with how. Why leads inexorably to paradox. How traps you in a universe of cause and effect. Both deny the infinite. The Apocrypha of Arrakis. Terraza told you, did she not, that we have gone through 11 of these Duncan Idaho Golas? This one is the 12th. The old Reverend Mother Shuang Yu spoke with deliberate bitterness as she looked down from the third-story parapet at the lone child playing on the enclosed lawn. The planet Gamu's bright midday sunlight bounced off the white courtyard walls, filling the area beneath them with brilliance as though a spotlight had been directed onto the young Gola. Gone through, the Reverend Mother Lucilla thought. She allowed herself a short nod, thinking how coldly impersonal were Shuang Yu's manner and choice of words. We have used up our supply. Send us more. The child on the lawn appeared to be about 12 standard years of age, but appearance could be deceptive, with a Gola not yet awakened to his original memories. The child took that moment to look up at the watchers above him. He was a sturdy figure with a direct gaze that focused intently from beneath a black cap of caracul hair. The yellow sunlight of early spring cast a small shadow at his feet. His skin was darkly tanned, but a slight movement of his body shifted his blue single suit, revealing pale skin at the left shoulder. Not only are these Golas costly, but they are supremely dangerous to us, Shuang Yu said. Her voice came out flat and emotionless, all the more powerful because of that. It was the voice of a Reverend Mother instructor, speaking down to an acolyte, and it emphasized for Lucilla that Shuang Yu was one of those who protested openly against the Gola project. Terraza had warned, she will try to win you over.
11 failures are enough, Shuang Yu said.
Lucilla glanced at Shuang Yu's wrinkled features, thinking suddenly, someday I may be old and wizened too, and perhaps I will be a power in the Bene Gesserit as well. Shuang Yu was a small woman, with many age marks earned in the sisterhood's affairs. Lucilla knew from her own assignment studies that Shuang Yu's conventional black robe concealed a skinny figure that few other than her acolyte dressers and the males bred to her had ever seen. Shuang Yu's mouth was wide, the lower lip constricted by the age lines that fanned into a jutting chin. Her manner tended to a curt abruptness that the uninitiated often interpreted as anger. The commander of the Gamu Keep was one who kept herself to herself more than most reverend mothers. Once more, Lucilla wished she knew the entire scope of the Gola project. Terraza had drawn the dividing line clearly enough, though. Shuang Yu is not to be trusted where the safety of the Gola is concerned.
We think that Leilaxu themselves killed most of the previous 11, Shuang Yu said. That in itself should tell us something.
Matching Shuang Yu's manner, Lucilla adopted a quiet attitude of almost emotionless waiting. Her manner said,
I may be much younger than you, Shuang Yu, but I too am a full reverend mother.
She could feel Shuang Yu's gaze. Shuang Yu had seen the hollows of this Lucilla, but the woman in the flesh was more disconcerting. An imprinter of the best training, no doubt of it. Blue-in-blue eyes, uncorrected by any lens, gave Lucilla a piercing expression that went with her long, oval face. With the hood of her black arbor robe thrown back as it was now, brown hair was revealed, drawn into a tight beret and then cascading down her back. Not even the stiffest robe could completely hide Lucilla's ample breasts. She was from a genetic line famous for its motherly nature, and she already had borne 3 children for the sisterhood, 2 to the same sire. Yes, a brown-haired charmer, with full breasts and a motherly disposition.
You say very little, Shuang Yu said, This tells me that Taraza has warned you against me.
Do you have reason to believe assassins will try to kill this 12th Gola? Lucilla asked.
They have already tried.
Strange how the word heresy came to mind when thinking of Shuang Yu, Lucilla thought. Could there be heresy among the Reverend Mothers? The religious overtones of the world seemed out of place in a Bene Gesserit context. How could there be heretical movements among people who held a profoundly manipulative attitude toward all things religious? Lucilla shifted her attention down to the Gola, who took this moment to perform a series of cartwheels that brought him around full circle until he once more stood looking up at the two observers on the parapet.
How prettily he performs,
Shuang Yu sneered. The old voice did not completely mask an underlying violence. Lucilla glanced at Shuang Yu. Heresy. Dissidence was not the proper word. Opposition did not cover what could be sensed in the older woman. This was something that could shatter the Bene Gesserit. Revolt against Taraza? Against the Reverend Mother Superior? Unthinkable. Mother Superiors were cast in the mould of monarch. Once Taraza had accepted counsel and advice and then made her decision, the sisters were committed to obedience.
This is no time to be creating new problems, Shuang Yu said.
Her meaning was clear. People from the scattering were coming back, and the intent of some among those lost ones threatened the sisterhood. Honored matres. How like Reverend Mothers the words sounded. Lucilla ventured an exploratory sally.
So you think we should be concentrating on the problem of those honored matres from the scattering?
Concentrating? Ha! They do not have our powers. They do not show good sense. They do not have mastery of melange. That is what they want from us, our spice knowledge.
Perhaps, Lucilla agreed. She was not willing to concede this on the scanty evidence.
Mother Superior Taraza has taken leave of her senses to dally with this Gola thing now,
Shuang Yu said. Lucilla remained silent. The Gola project definitely had touched an old nerve among the sisters. The possibility, even remote, that they might arouse another Kwisatz Haderach sent shudders of angry fear through the ranks, to meddle with the worm-bound remnants of a tyrant. That was dangerous in the extreme.
We should never take that Gola to Rakis,
Shuang Yu muttered.
Let sleeping worms lie.
Lucilla gave her attention once more to the Gola child. He had turned his back on the high parapet with its two reverend mothers, but something about his posture said he knew they discussed him, and he awaited their response.
You doubtless realize that you have been called in while he is yet too young,
Shuang Yu said.
I have never heard of the deep imprinting on one that young,
Lucilla agreed. She allowed something softly self-mocking in her tone, a thing she knew Shuang Yu would hear and misinterpret. The management of procreation and all of its attendant necessities, that was the Bene Gesserit ultimate specialty. Use love, but avoid it, Shuang Yu would be thinking now. The sisterhood's analysts knew the roots of love. They had examined this quite early in their development, but had never dared breed it out of those they influenced. Tolerate love, but guard against it, that was the rule. Know that it lay deep within the human genetic makeup, a safety net to ensure continuation of the species. You used it where necessary, imprinting selected individuals, sometimes upon each other, for the sisterhood's purposes, knowing then that such individuals would be linked by powerful bonding lines not readily available to the common awareness. Others might observe such links and plot the consequences, but the linked ones would dance to unconscious music.
I was not suggesting that it's a mistake to imprint him,
Shuang Yu said, misreading Lucilla's silence.
We do what we are ordered to do, Lucilla chided.
Let Shuang Yu make of that what she would.
Then you do not object to taking the Gola to Rakis,
Shuang Yu said.
I wonder if you would continue such unquestioning obedience if you knew the full story.
Lucilla inhaled a deep breath. Was the entire design for the Duncan Idaho Golas to be shared with her now?
There is a female child named Shiana Brug on Rakis,
Shuang Yu said.
She can control the giant worms.
Lucilla concealed her alertness. Giant worms. Not Shai Hulud. Not Shaitan. Giant worms. The sand rider predicted by the tyrant had appeared at last.
I do not make idle chatter,
Shuang Yu said when Lucilla continued silent. Indeed not, Lucilla thought. And you call a thing by its descriptive label, not by the name of its mystical import, giant worms. And you're really thinking about the tyrant, Leto the Second, whose endless dream is carried as a pearl of awareness in each of those worms, or so we are led to believe. Shuang Yu nodded toward the child on the lawn below them.
Do you think their gola will be able to influence the girl who controls the worms?
We're peeling away the skin at last, Lucilla thought. She said, I have no need for the answer to such a question.
You are a cautious one, Shuang Yu said.
Lucilla arched her back and stretched. Cautious? Yes, indeed. Terraza had warned her.
Where Shuang Yu is concerned, you must act with extreme caution, but with speed. We have a very narrow window of time within which we can succeed.
Succeed at what? Lucilla wondered. She glanced sideways at Shuang Yu.
I don't see how the Tleilaxu could succeed in killing 11 of these golas. How could they get through our defences?
We have the Basha now, Shuang Yu said. Perhaps he can prevent disaster.
Her tone said she did not believe this. Mother Superior Terraza had said,
You are the imprinter, Lucilla. When you get to Gamu, you will recognize some of the pattern. But for your task, you have no need for the full design.
Think of the cost,
Shuang Yu said, glaring down at the gola who now squatted, pulling at tufts of grass. Cost had nothing to do with it, Lucilla knew. The open admission of failure was much more important. The sisterhood could not reveal its fallibility. But the fact that an imprinter had been summoned early, that was vital. Terraza had known the imprinter would see this and recognize part of the pattern. Shuang Yu gestured with one bony hand at the child, who had returned to his solitary play, running and tumbling on the grass.
Politics, Shuang Yu said.
No doubt sisterhood politics lay at the core of Shuang Yu's heresy, Lucilla thought. The delicacy of the internal argument could be deduced from the fact that Shuang Yu had been put in charge of the keep here on Gamu. Those who opposed Terraza refused to sit on the sidelines. Shuang Yu turned and looked squarely at Lucilla. Enough had been said. Enough had been heard and screened through minds trained in Bene Gesserit awareness. The chapter house had chosen this Lucilla with great care. Lucilla felt the older woman's careful examination, but refused to let this touch that innermost sense of purpose upon which every reverend mother could rely in times of stress.
Here, let her look fully upon me.
Lucilla turned and set her mouth in a soft smile, passing her gaze across the rooftop opposite them. A uniformed man, armed with a heavy-duty laser gun, appeared there, looked once at the two reverend mothers and then focused on the child below them.
Who is that? Lucilla asked.
Patrin, the Basha's most trusted aide. Says he's only the Basha's batman, but you'd have to be blind and a fool to believe that.
Lucilla examined the man across from them with care. So that was Patrin, a native of Gamo, Terraza had said, chosen for this task by the Basha himself. Thin and blonde, much too old now to be soldiering, but then the Basha had been called back from retirement and had insisted Patrin must share this duty. Shuang Yu noted the way Lucilla shifted her attention from Patrin to the gola with real concern. Yes, if the Basha had been called back to guard this keep, then the gola was in extreme peril. Lucilla started in sudden surprise.
Why, he's...
Miles Tegg's orders,
Shuang Yu said, naming the Basha.
All of the Gola's play is training play. Muscles are to be prepared for the day when he is restored to his original self.
But that's no simple exercise he's doing down there, Lucilla said. She felt her own muscles respond sympathetically to the remembered training.
We hold back only the Sisterhood's arcana from this Gola, Shuang Yu said. Almost anything else in our storehouse of knowledge can be his.
Her tone said she found this extremely objectionable.
Surely no one can believe this Gola could become another Kwisatz Haderach, Lucilla objected.
Shuang Yu merely shrugged. Lucilla held herself quite still, thinking. Was it possible the Gola could be transformed into a male version of a reverend mother? Could this Duncan Idaho learn to look inward where no reverend mother dared?
Shuang Yu began to speak, her voice almost a growling mutter. The design of this project, they have a dangerous plan. They could make the same mistake.
She broke off.
They, Lucilla thought, their Gola. I would give anything to know for sure the position of Ix and the fish speakers in this, Lucilla said.
Fish speakers?
Shuang Yu shook her head at the very thought of the remnant female army that had once served only the tyrant.
They believe in truth and justice.
Lucilla overcame a sudden tightness in her throat. Shuang Yu had all but declared open opposition. Yet, she commanded here. The political rule was a simple one. Those who opposed the project must monitor it, that they might abort it at the first sign of trouble. But that was a genuine Duncan Idaho Gola down there on the lawn. Cell comparisons and truthsayers had confirmed it. Taraza had said,
You are to teach him love in all of its forms.
He's so young, Lucilla said, keeping her attention on the Gola.
Young, yes, Shuang Yu said. So, for now, I presume you will awaken his childish responses to maternal affection. Later,
Shuang Yu shrugged. Lucilla betrayed no emotional reaction. A Bene Gesserit obeyed.
I am an imprinter. So,
Taraza's orders and the imprinter's specialized training defined a particular course of events. To Shuang Yu, Lucilla said,
There is someone who looks like me and speaks with my voice. I am imprinting for her. May I ask who that is?
No.
Lucilla held her silence. She had not expected revelation, but it had been remarked more than once that she bore a striking resemblance to senior security mother Darwi O'Draid.
A young O'Draid,
Lucilla had heard this on several occasions. Both Lucilla and O'Draid were, of course, in the Atreides line, with a strong back breeding from Siona descendants. The fish speakers had no monopoly on those genes. But the other memories of a reverend mother, even with their linear selectivity and confinement to the female side, provided important clues to the broad shape of the Gola project. Lucilla, who had come to depend on her experiences of the Jessica persona, buried some 5,000 years back in the sisterhood's genetic manipulations, felt a deep sense of dread from that source now. There was a familiar pattern here. It gave off such an intense feeling of doom that Lucilla fell automatically into the litany against fear as she had been taught it in her first introduction to the Sisterhood's rites.
I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye to see its path. Where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain.
Calm returned to Lucilla. Shuang Yu, sensing some of this, allowed her guard to drop slightly. Lucilla was no dullard, no special reverend mother with an empty title and barely sufficient background to function without embarrassing the sisterhood. Lucilla was the real thing, and some reactions could not be hidden from her, not even reactions of another reverend mother. Very well. Let her know the full extent of the opposition to this foolish, this dangerous project.
I do not think their Gola will survive to see Rakkus, Shuang Yu said.
Lucilla let this pass.
Tell me about his friends, she said.
He has no friends, only teachers.
When will I meet them?
She kept her gaze on the opposite parapet, where Patrin leaned idly against a low pillar, his heavy laser gun at the ready. Lucilla realized, with an abrupt shock, that Patrin was watching her. Patrin was a message from the Basha. Shuang Yu obviously saw and understood.
We guard him.
I presume it's Miles Teg you're so anxious to meet, Shuang Yu said.
Among others?
Don't you want to make contact with Agola first?
I've already made contact with him.
Lucilla nodded toward the enclosed yard, where the child once more stood almost motionless and looked up at her.
He's a thoughtful one.
I've only the reports on the others, Shuang Yu said, but I suspect this is the most thoughtful one of the series.
Lucilla suppressed an involuntary shudder at the readiness for violent opposition in Shuang Yu's words and attitude. There was not one hint that the child below them shared a common humanity. While Lucilla was thinking this, clouds covered the sun, as they often did here at this hour. A cold wind blew in over the keep's walls, swirling around the courtyard. The child turned away and picked up the speed of his exercises, getting his warmth from increased activity.
Where does he go to be alone?
Lucilla asked.
Mostly to his room. He has tried a few dangerous escapades, but we have discouraged this.
He must hate us very much.
I'm sure of it.
I will have to deal with that directly.
Surely an imprinter has no doubts about her ability to overcome hate.
I was thinking of Gyasa.
Lucilla sent a knowing look at Shuang Yu.
I find it astonishing that you let Gyasa make such a mistake.
I don't interfere with the normal progress of the Gola's instructions. If one of his teachers develops a real affection for him, that is not my problem.
An attractive child, Lucilla said.
They stood a bit longer, watching the Duncan Idaho Gola at his training play. Both Reverend Mothers thought briefly of Gyasa, one of the first teachers brought here for the Gola project. Shuang Yu's attitude was plain.
Gyasa was a providential failure.
Lucilla thought only, Shuang Yu and Gyasa complicated my task.
Neither woman gave even a passing moment to the way these thoughts reaffirmed their loyalties. As she watched the child in the courtyard, Lucilla began to have a new appreciation of what the tyrant god emperor had actually achieved. Leto II had employed this Gola type through uncounted lifetimes, some 3,500 years of them, one after another. And the god emperor Leto II had been no ordinary force of nature. He had been the biggest juggernaut in human history, rolling over everything, over social systems, over natural and unnatural hatreds, over governmental forms, over rituals, both taboo and mandatory, over religions casual and religions intense. The crushing weight of the tyrant's passage had left nothing unmarked, not even the Bene Gesserit. Later II had called it the Golden Path, and this Duncan Idaho-type Gola below her now had figured prominently in that awesome passage. Lucilla had studied the Bene Gesserit accounts, probably the best in the universe. Even today, on most of the old imperial planets, newly married couples still scattered dollops of water east and west, mouthing the local version of, Let thy blessings flow back to us from this offering, O God of infinite power and infinite mercy. Once it had been the task of fish speakers and their tame priesthood to enforce such obeisance. But the thing had developed its own momentum, becoming a pervasive compulsion. Even the most doubting of believers said, well, it can do no harm. It was an accomplishment that the finest religious engineers of the Bene Gesserit Missionaria Protectiva admired with frustrated awe. The tyrant had surpassed the Bene Gesserit best. And 1,500 years since the tyrant's death, the sisterhood remained powerless to unlock the central knot of that fearsome accomplishment.
Who has charge of the child's religious training?
Lucilla asked.
No one, Shuang Yu said. Why bother? If he is reawakened to his original memories, he will have his own ideas. We will deal with those if we ever have to.
The child below them completed his allotted training time. Without another look up at the watchers on the parapet, he left the enclosed yard and entered a wide doorway on the left. Partrin, too, abandoned his guard position without glancing at the two reverend mothers.
"Don't be fooled by Teg's people," Shuang Yu said. "They have eyes in the backs of their heads. Teg's birth mother, you know, was one of us. He is teaching that Gola things better never shared."
Explosions are also compressions of time. Observable changes in the natural universe all are explosive to some degree and from some point of view, otherwise you would not notice them. Smooth continuity of change, if slowed sufficiently, goes without notice by observers whose time attention span is too short. Thus, I tell you, I have seen changes you would never have marked.
Plato the Second. The woman standing in Chapter House Planet's morning light across the table from the Reverend Mother Superior Alma Mavis Taraza was tall and supple. The long arbor robe that encased her in shimmering black from shoulders to floor did not completely conceal the grace with which her body expressed every movement. Taraza leaned forward in her chair dog and scanned the record's relay, projecting its condensed Bene Gesserit glyphs above the tabletop for her eyes only. Dawi O'Draid, the display identified the standing woman, and then came the essential biography, which Taraza already knew in detail. The display served several purposes. It provided a secure reminder for the Mother Superior. It allowed an occasional delay for thought while she appeared to scan the records, and it was a final argument should something negative arise from this interview. O'Draid had borne 19 children for the Bene Gesserit, Taraza observed as the information scrolled past her eyes. Each child by a different father. Not much unusual about that, but even the most searching gaze could see that this essential service to the sisterhood had not grossened O'Draid's flesh. Her features conveyed a natural hauteur in the long nose and the complementary angular cheeks. Every feature focused downward to a narrow chin. Her mouth, though, was full, and promised a passion that she was careful to bridle. "We can always depend on the Atreides genes," Taraza thought. A window curtain fluttered behind O'Draid, and she glanced back at it. They were in Taraza's morning room, a small and elegantly furnished space decorated in shades of green. Only the stark white of Taraza's chair dog separated her from the background. The room's bow windows looked eastward onto garden and lawn with faraway snowy mountains of Chapter House Planet as backdrop. Without looking up, Taraza said,
"I was glad when both you and Lucilla accepted the assignment. It makes my task much easier."
"I would like to have met this Lucilla," O'Draid said, looking down at the top of Taraza's head.
O'Draid's voice came out a soft contralto.
Taraza cleared her throat. "No need. Lucilla is one of our finest imprinters. Each of you, of course, received the identical liberal conditioning to prepare you for this."
There was something almost insulting in Taraza's casual tone, and only the habits of long association put down O'Draid's immediate resentment. It was partly that word, liberal, she realized. Atreides' ancestors rose up in rebellion at the word. It was as though her accumulated female memories lashed out at the unconscious assumptions and unexamined prejudices behind the concept. Only liberals really think. Only liberals are intellectual. Only liberals understand the needs of their fellows. How much viciousness lay concealed in that word, O'Draid thought. How much secret ego demanding to feel superior. O'Draid reminded herself that Taraza, despite the casually insulting tone, had used the term only in its Catholic sense. Lucilla's generalized education had been carefully matched to that of O'Draid. Taraza leaned back into a more comfortable position, but still kept her attention on the display in front of her. The light from the eastern windows fell directly on her face, leaving shadows beneath nose and chin. A small woman, just a bit older than Odraid, Terraza retained much of the beauty that had made her a most reliable breeder with difficult sires. Her face was a long oval, with soft curved cheeks. She wore her black hair drawn back tightly from a high forehead with a pronounced peak. Terraza's mouth opened minimally when she spoke, superb control of movement. An observer's attention tended to focus on her eyes, that compelling blue-in-blue. The total effect was of a suave facial mask from which little escaped to betray her true emotions. Odraid recognized this present pose in the Mother Superior. Terraza would mutter to herself presently. Indeed, right on cue, Terraza muttered to herself. The Mother Superior was thinking while she followed the biographical display with great attention. Many matters occupied her attention. This was a reassuring thought to Odraid. Terraza did not believe there was any such thing as a beneficent power guarding humankind. The Missionaria Protectiva and the intentions of the Sisterhood counted for everything in Terraza's universe. Whatever served those intentions, even the machinations of the long-dead tyrant, could be judged good. All else was evil. Alien intrusions from the scattering, especially those returning descendants who called themselves honored matres, were not to be trusted. Terraza's own people, even those reverend mothers who opposed her in council, were the ultimate Bene Gesserit resource, the only thing that could be trusted. Still without looking up, Terraza said, "Do you know that when you compare the millennia preceding the tyrant with those after his death, the decrease in major conflicts is phenomenal? Since the tyrant, the number of such conflicts has dropped to less than 2% of what it was before." "As far as we know," Odraid said. Terraza's gaze flicked upward and then down. "What? We have no way of telling how many wars have been fought outside our ken. Have you statistics from the people of the scattering?" "Of course not." "Leto Tandus is what you're saying," Odraid said. "If you care to put it that way." Terraza inserted a marker in something she saw on her display. "Shouldn't some of the credit go to our beloved Bashar Miles Teg?" Odraid asked, "or to his talented predecessors?" "We chose those people," Terraza said. "I don't see the pertinence of this martial discussion," Odraid said. "What does it have to do with our present problem?" "There are some who think we may revert to the pre-tyrant condition with a very nasty bang." "Oh?" Odraid pursed her lips. "Several groups among our returning lost ones are selling arms to anyone who wants to or can buy."
"Specifics?" Odraid asked.
"Sophisticated arms are flooding onto Gamu, and there can be little doubt that Lelaxu are stockpiling some of the nastier weapons." Terraza leaned back and rubbed her temples. She spoke in a low, almost musing voice. "We think we make decisions of the greatest moment and out of the very highest principles."
Odraid had seen this before, too. She said, "Does the Mother Superior doubt the rightness of the Bene Gesserit?"
"Doubt? Oh, no. But I do experience frustration. We work all of our lives for these highly refined goals, and in the end, what do we find? We find that many of the things to which we have dedicated our lives came from petty decisions. They can be traced to desires for personal comfort or convenience, and had nothing at all to do with our high ideals. What really was at stake was some worldly working agreement that satisfied the needs of those who could make the decisions."
"I've heard you call that political necessity," Odraid said.
Terraza spoke with tight control while returning her attention to the display in front of her. "If we become institutionalized in our judgments, that's a sure way to extinguish the Bene Gesserit."
"You will not find petty decisions in my bio," Odraid said.
"I look for sources of weakness, for flaws."
"You won't find those either."
Terraza concealed a smile. She recognized this egocentric remark, Odraid's way of needling the Mother Superior. Odraid was very good at seeming to be impatient while actually suspending herself in a timeless flow of patience. When Terraza did not rise to the bait, Audrade resumed her calm waiting, easy breaths, the mind steady. Patience came without thinking of it. The sisterhood had taught her long ago how to divide past and present into simultaneous flowings. While observing her immediate surroundings, she could pick up bits and pieces of her past and live through them as though they moved across a screen superimposed over the present. Memory work, Audrade thought. Necessary things to haul out and lay to rest, removing the barriers. When all else palled, there was still her tangled childhood. There had been a time when Audrade lived as most children lived, in a house with a man and woman who, if not her parents, certainly acted in loco parentis. All of the other children she knew then lived in similar situations. They had papas and mamas. Sometimes only papa worked away from home, sometimes only mamma went out to her labours. In Audrade's case, the woman remained at home, and no creche nurse guarded the child in the working hours. Much later, Audrade learned that her birth mother had given a large sum of money to provide this for the infant female hidden in plain sight that way. "She hid you with us because she loved you," the woman explained when Audrade was old enough to understand. "That is why you must never reveal that we are not your real parents." Love had nothing to do with it, Audrade learned later. Reverend mothers did not act from such mundane motives, and Audrade's birth mother had been a Bene Gesserit sister. All of this was revealed to Audrade according to the original plan. Her name, Audrade. Dawi was what she had always been called when the caller was not being endearing or angry. Young friends naturally shortened it to Da. Everything, however, did not go according to the original plan. Audrade recalled a narrow bed in a room brightened by paintings of animals and fantasy landscapes on the pastel blue walls. White curtains fluttered at the window in the soft breezes of spring and summer. Audrade remembered jumping on the narrow bed, a marvellously happy game, up, down, much laughter. Arms caught her in mid-leap and hugged her close. They were a man's arms, a round face with a small moustache that tickled her into giggles. The bed thumped the wall when she jumped, and the wall revealed indentations from this movement. Audrade played over this memory now, reluctant to discard it into the well of rationality. Marks on a wall, marks of laughter and joy. How small they were, to represent so much. Odd how she had been thinking more and more about Papa recently. All of the memories were not happy. There had been times when he had been sad angry, warning Mama not to become too involved. He had a face that reflected many frustrations. His voice barked when he was in his angry mood. Mama moved softly then, her eyes full of worry. Audrade sensed the worry and the fear, and resented the man. The woman knew best how to deal with him. She kissed the nape of his neck, stroked his cheek, and whispered into his ear. These ancient, natural emotions had engaged a Bene Gesserit analyst proctor in much work with Audrade before they were exorcised, but even now there was residual detritus to pick up and discard. Even now, Audrade knew that all of it was not gone. Seeing the way Terraza studied the biographical record with such care, Audrade wondered if that was the flaw the Mother Superior saw. "Surely they know by now that I can deal with the emotions of those early times." It was all so long ago. Still, she had to admit that the memory of the man and woman lay within her, bonded with such force that it might never be erased completely. Especially Mama. The Reverend Mother in extremis who had borne Audrade had put her in that hiding place on Gamu for reasons Audrade now understood quite well. Audrade harboured no resentments. It had been necessary for the survival of them both. Problems arose from the fact that the foster mother gave Audrade that thing which most mothers give their children, that thing which the sisterhood so distrusted. Love. When the Reverend Mothers came, the foster mother had not fought the removal of her child. Two reverend mothers came with a contingent of male and female proctors. Afterward, Audrade was a long time understanding the significance of that wrenching moment. The woman had known in her heart that the day of parting would come. only a matter of time. Still, as the days became years, almost 6 standards of years, the woman had dared to hope. Then the Reverend Mothers came with their burly attendants. They had merely been waiting until it was safe, until they were sure no hunters knew this was a Bene Gesserit planned Atreides scion. Odrade saw a great deal of money passed to the foster mother. The woman threw the money on the floor. But no voice was raised in objection. The adults in the scene knew where the power lay. Calling up those compressed emotions, Odrade could still see the woman take herself to a straight-backed chair beside the window onto the street, there to hug herself and rock back and forth, back and forth. Not a sound from her. The Reverend Mothers used voice and their considerable wiles, plus the smoke of drugging herbs and their overpowering presence to lure Odrade into their waiting ground car. "It will be just for a little while. Your real mother sent us." Odrade sensed the lies, but curiosity compelled. "My real mother?" Her last view of the woman who had been her only known female parent was of that figure at the window rocking back and forth, a look of misery on her face, arms wrapped around herself. Later, when Odrade spoke of returning to the woman, that memory vision was incorporated into an essential Bene Gesserit lesson. Love leads to misery. Love is a very ancient force which served its purpose in its day, but no longer is essential for the survival of the species. Remember that woman's mistake. The pain. Until well into her teens, Odrade adjusted by daydreaming. She would really return after she was a full Reverend Mother. She would go back and find that loving woman, find her even though she had no names except Mama and Sibia. Odrade recalled the laughter of adult friends who had called the woman Sibia. Mama Sibia. The sisters, however, detected the daydreams and searched out their source. That, too, was incorporated into a lesson. Daydreaming is the first awakening of what we call simul-flow. It is an essential tool of rational thought. With it you can clear the mind for better thinking. Simul-flow. Odrade focused on Terraza at the morning room table. Childhood trauma must be placed carefully into a reconstructed memory place. All of that had been far away on Gamu, the planet that the people of Dan had rebuilt after the famine times and the scattering. The people of Dan, Caladan in those days. Odrade took a firm grip on rational thought, using the stance of the other memories that had flooded into her awareness during the spice agony when she had really become a full Reverend Mother. Simul flow. The filter of consciousness. Other memories. What powerful tools the sisterhood had given her. What dangerous tools. All of those other lives lay there just beyond the curtain of awareness, tools of survival, not a way to satisfy casual curiosity. Terraza spoke, translating from the material that scrolled past her eyes. "You dig too much in your other memories. That drains away energies better conserved." The Mother Superior's blue-in-blue eyes sent a piercing stare upward at Odrade. "You sometimes go right to the edge of fleshly tolerance. That can lead to your premature death." "I am careful with the spice, Mother." "And well you should be. A body can take only so much, Melange, only so much prowling in its past." "Have you found my flaw?" Odrade asked. "Gamo." One word, but an entire harangue. Odrade knew. The unavoidable trauma of those lost years on Gamu. They were a distraction that had to be rooted out and made rationally acceptable. "But I am sent to Rakis," Odrade said. "And see that you remember the aphorisms of moderation. Remember who you are." Once more Terraza bent to her display. "I am Odrade," Odrade thought. In the Bene Gesserit schools where first names tended to slip away, roll call was by last name. Friends and acquaintances picked up the habit of using the roll call name. They learned early that sharing secret or private names was an ancient device for ensnaring a person in affections. Terraza, 3 classes ahead of Odrade, had been assigned to bring the younger girl along, a deliberate association by watchful teachers. Bringing along meant a certain amount of lording it over the younger, but also incorporated essentials better taught by someone closer to peer relationship. Terraza, with access to the private records of her trainee, started calling the younger girl Da. Audrade responded by calling Terraza Ta. The two names acquired a certain glue, Da and Ta. Even after Reverend Mothers overheard and reprimanded them, they occasionally lapsed into error, if only for the amusement. Audrade, looking down at Terraza now, said, Da and Ta. A smile twitched the edges of Terraza's mouth.
What is it in my records that you don't already know several times over? Audrade asked.
Terraza sat back and waited for the chair dog to adjust itself to the new position. She rested her clasped hands on the tabletop and looked up at the younger woman.
Not much younger, really, Terraza thought.
Since school, though, Terraza had thought of Audrade as completely removed into a younger age group, creating a gap no passage of years could close.
Care at the beginning, Da,
Terraza said. This project is well past its beginning, Audrade said.
But your part in it starts now, and we are launching ourselves into such a beginning as has never before been attempted.
Am I now to learn the entire design for this gola?
No.
That was it. All the evidence of high-level dispute and the need to know cast away with a single word. But Audrade understood. There was an organizational rubric laid down by the original Bene Gesserit chapter house, which had endured with only minor changes for millennia. Bene Gesserit divisions were cut by hard, vertical and horizontal barriers, divided into isolated groups that converged to a single command only here at the top. Duties, for which read assigned roles, were conducted within separate cells. Active participants within a cell did not know their contemporaries within other parallel cells.
But I know that the Reverend Mother Lucilla is in a parallel cell, Audrade thought. It's the logical answer.
She recognized the necessity. It was an ancient design copied from secret revolutionary societies. The Bene Gesserit had always seen themselves as permanent revolutionaries. It was a revolution that had been dampened only in the time of the tyrant, Leto II.
Dampened, but not diverted or stopped, Audrade reminded herself.
In what you're about to do, Terraza said, tell me if you sense any immediate threat to the sisterhood.
It was one of Terraza's peculiar demands, which Audrade had learned to answer out of wordless instinct, which then could be formed into words. Quickly, she said,
If we fail to act, that is worse.
We reasoned that there would be danger, Terraza said.
She spoke in a dry, remote voice. Terraza did not like calling up this talent in Audrade. The younger woman possessed a prescient instinct for detecting threats to the sisterhood. It came from the wild influence in her genetic line, of course. The Atreides with their dangerous talents. There was a special mark on Odrade's breeding file. Careful examination of all offspring. Two of those offspring had been quietly put to death.
I should not have awakened Audrade's talent now, not even for a moment, Terraza thought. But sometimes temptation was very great.
Terraza sealed the projector into her tabletop and looked at the blank surface while speaking.
Even if you find a perfect sire, you are not to breed without our permission while you are away from us.
The mistake of my natural mother, Audrade said.
The mistake of your natural mother was to be recognized while she was breeding.
Audrade had heard this before. There was that thing about the Atreides line that required the most careful monitoring by the breeding mistresses. The wild talent, of course. She knew about the wild talent, that genetic force which had produced the Kwisatz Haderach and the tyrant. What did the breeding mistresses seek now, though? Was their approach mostly negative? No more dangerous births. She had never seen any of her babies after they were born, not necessarily a curious thing for the sisterhood, and she never saw any of the records in her own genetic file. Here, too, the sisterhood operated with careful separation of powers.
and those earlier prohibitions on my other memories.
She had found the blank spaces in her memories and opened them. It was probable that only Terrazza and perhaps two other counsellors, Belonda most likely, and one other older Reverend Mother, shared the more sensitive access to such breeding information. Had Terrazza and the other really sworn to die before revealing privileged information to an outsider? There was, after all, a precise ritual of succession should a key Reverend Mother die while away from her sisters and with no chance to pass along her encapsulated lives. The ritual had been called into play many times during the reign of the tyrant. A terrible period. Knowing that the revolutionary cells of the sisterhood were transparent to him. Monster. She knew that her sisters had never deluded themselves that Leto II refrained from destroying the Bene Gesserit out of some deep-seated loyalty to his grandmother, the Lady Jessica.
"Are you there, Jessica?"
Audrade felt the stirring far within. The failure of one reverend mother. She allowed herself to fall in love. Such a small thing. But how great the consequences. 3,500 years of tyranny. The golden path. Infinite. What of the lost mega-trillions gone into the scattering? What threat was posed by those lost ones returning now? As though she read Odraid's mind, which sometimes she appeared to do, Terrazza said,
"The scattered ones are out there, just waiting to pounce."
Odraid had heard the arguments, danger on the one hand and on the other, something magnetically attractive, so many magnificent unknowns, the sisterhood with its talents honed by Melange over the millennia. What might they not do with such untapped resources of humanity? Think of the uncounted genes out there. Think of the potential talents floating free in universes where they might be lost forever.
"It's the not knowing that conjures up the greatest terrors," Odraide said.
"And the greatest ambitions," Terrazza said.
"Then do I go to Rakkis?"
"In due course. I find you adequate to the task,
or you would not have assigned me."
It was an old exchange between them, going right back to their school days. Terrazza realized, though, that she had not entered it consciously. Too many memories tangled the two of them. Dar and Tar. Have to watch that.
"Remember where your loyalties are," Terrazza said.
The existence of no ships raises the possibility of destroying entire planets without retaliation. A large object, asteroid or equivalent, may be sent against the planet, or the people can be set against each other by sexual subversion and then can be armed to destroy themselves. These honoured matres appear to favour this latter technique. Bene Gesserit Analysis. From his position in the courtyard, and even when not appearing to do so, Duncan Idaho kept his attention on the observers above him. There was Patrin, of course, but Patrin did not count. It was the Reverend Mothers across from Patrin who bore watching. Seeing Lucilla, he thought, "That's the new one." This thought filled him with a surge of excitement, which he took out in renewed exercise. He completed the first 3 patterns of the training play Miles Tegg had ordered, vaguely aware that Patrin would report on how well he did. Duncan liked Tegg and old Patrin and sensed that the feeling was reciprocated. This new Reverend Mother, though, her presence suggested interesting changes. For one thing, she was younger than the others. Also, this new one did not try to hide the eyes that were a first clue to her membership in the Bene Gesserit. His first glimpse of Shuang Yu had confronted him with eyes concealed behind contact lenses that simulated non-addict pupils and slightly bloodshot whites. He had heard one of the keep's acolytes say Shuang Yu's lenses also corrected for an astigmatic weakness that has been accepted in her genetic line as a reasonable exchange for the other qualities she transmits to her offspring. At the time, most of this remark was unintelligible to Duncan, but he had looked up the references in the keep's library, references both scarce and severely limited in content. Shuang Yu herself parried all of his questions on the subject, but the subsequent behaviour of his teachers told him she had been angry. Typically, she had taken out her anger on others. What really upset her, he suspected, was his demand to know whether she was his mother. For a long time now, Duncan had known he was something special. There were places in the elaborate compound of this Bene Gesserit keep where he was not permitted. He had found private ways to evade such prohibitions, and had stared out often through thick plaza and open windows at guards and wide reaches of cleared ground that could be enfiladed from strategically positioned pillboxes. Miles Tegg himself had taught the significance of enfilade positioning. Gamu, the planet was called now. Once it had been known as Gidi Prime, but someone named Gurney Halleck had changed that. It was all ancient history. Dull stuff. There still remained a faint smell of bitter oil in the planet's dirt from its pre-Danian days. Millennia of special plantations were changing that, his teachers explained. He could see part of this from the keep. Forests of conifers and other trees surrounded them here. Still covertly watching the two reverend mothers, Duncan did a series of cartwheels. He flexed his striking muscles as he moved, just the way Tegg had taught him. Tegg also instructed in planetary defences. Gamu was ringed by orbiting monitors whose crews could not have their families aboard. The families remained down here on Gamu, hostage to the vigilance of those guardian orbiters. Somewhere among the ships in space, there were undetectable no-ships, whose crews were composed entirely of the Basha's people and Bene Gesserit sisters.
"I would not have taken this assignment without full charge of all defensive arrangements," Tegg explained.
Duncan realized that he was this assignment. The keep was here to protect him. Tegg's orbiting monitors, including the no-ships, protected the keep. It was all part of a military education whose elements Duncan found somehow familiar. Learning how to defend a seemingly vulnerable planet from attacks originating in space, he knew when those defenses were correctly placed. It was extremely complicated as a whole, but the elements were identifiable and could be understood. There was, for instance, the constant monitoring of atmosphere and the blood serum of Gamu's inhabitants. Souk doctors in the pay of the Bene Gesserit were everywhere.
"Diseases are weapons," Tegg said. "Our defense against diseases must be finely tuned."
Frequently, Tegg railed against passive defenses. He called them
the product of a siege mentality long known to create deadly weaknesses.
When it came to military instructions from Tegg, Duncan listened carefully. Patrin and the library records confirmed that the Mentat Basha Miles Tegg had been a famous military leader for the Bene Gesserit. Patrin often referred to their service together, and always Tegg was the hero.
"Mobility is the key to military success," Tegg said. "If you're tied down in forts, even whole planet forts, you are ultimately vulnerable."
Tegg did not much care for Gamu.
"I see that you already know this place was called Gidi Prime once. The Harkonnens who ruled here taught us a few things. We have a better idea, thanks to them, of how terrifyingly brutal humans can become."
As he recalled this, Duncan observed that the two reverend mothers watching from the parapet obviously were discussing him. "Am I the new one's assignment?" Duncan did not like being watched, and he hoped the new one would allow him some time to himself. She did not look like a tough one, not like Shuang Yu. As he continued his exercises, Duncan timed them to a private litany. "Damn Shuang Yu! Damn Shuang Yu!" He had hated Shuang Yu from the age of 9, 4 years now. She did not know his hate, he thought. She had probably forgotten all about the incident where his hate had been ignited. Barely 9, and he had managed to slip through the inner guards out into a tunnel that led to one of the pillboxes. Smell of fungus in the tunnel, dim lights, dampness. He peered out through the box's weapons slits before being caught and hustled back into the core of the keep. This escapade occasioned a stern lecture from Shuang Yu, a remote and threatening figure whose orders must be obeyed. That was how he still thought of her, although he had since learned about the Bene Gesserit voice of command, that vocal subtlety which could bend the will of an untrained listener. She must be obeyed.
"You have occasioned the disciplining of an entire guard unit," Shuang Yu said. "They will be severely punished."
That had been the most terrible part of her lecture. Duncan liked some of the guards, and occasionally lured some of them into real play with laughter and tumbling. His prank, sneaking out to the pillbox, had hurt his friends. Duncan knew what it was to be punished.
"Damn Shuang Yu! Damn Shuang Yu!"
After Shuang Yu's lecture, Duncan ran to his chief instructor of the moment, Reverend Mother Tamerlane, another of the wizened old ones with a cool and aloof manner, snowy hair above a narrow face and a leather skin. He demanded of Tamerlane to know about the punishment of his guards. Tamerlane fell into a surprising, pensive mood, her voice like sand rasping against wood.
"Punishments? Well.
They were in the small teaching room off the larger practice floor where Tamerlane went each evening to prepare the next day's lessons. It was a place of bubble and spool readers and other sophisticated means for information storage and retrieval. Duncan far preferred it to the library, but he was not allowed in the teaching room unattended. It was a bright room lighted by many Suspenser Boyd glow globes. At his intrusion, Tamerlane turned away from where she laid out his lessons.
"There's always something of a sacrificial banquet about our major punishments," she said. "The guards will, of course, receive major punishment."
"Banquet?" Duncan was puzzled. Tamerlane swung completely around in her swivel seat and looked directly into his eyes. Her steely teeth glittered in the bright lights.
"History has seldom been good to those who must be punished," she said.
Duncan flinched at the word history. It was one of Tamerlane's signals. She was going to teach a lesson, another boring lesson.
"Bene Gesserit punishments cannot be forgotten."
Duncan focused on Tamerlane's old mouth, sensing abruptly that she spoke out of painful personal experience. He was going to learn something interesting.
"Our punishments carry an inescapable lesson," Tamerlane said. "It is much more than the pain."
Duncan sat on the floor at her feet. From this angle, Tamerlane was a black, shrouded, and ominous figure.
"We do not punish with the ultimate agony," she said. "That is reserved for a Reverend Mother's passage through the spice."
Duncan nodded. Library records referred to spice agony, a mysterious trial that created a Reverend Mother.
"Major punishments are painful nonetheless," she said. "They are also emotionally painful. Emotion evoked by punishment is always that emotion we judge to be the penitent's greatest weakness, and thus we strengthen the punished."
Her words filled Duncan with unfocused dread. What were they doing to his guards? He could not speak, but there was no need. Tamerlane was not finished.
"The punishment always ends with a dessert," she said, and she clapped her hands against her knees.
Duncan frowned. Dessert? That was part of a banquet. How could a banquet be punishment?
"It is not really a banquet, but the idea of a banquet," Tamerlane said.
One claw-like hand described a circle in the air.
"The dessert comes. Something totally unexpected. The penitent thinks, 'Ah, I have been forgiven at last.' You understand?"
Duncan shook his head from side to side. No, he did not understand.
"It is the sweetness of the moment," she said. "You have been through every course of a painful banquet and come out at the end to something you can savour. But as you savour it, then comes the most painful moment of all, the recognition, the understanding that this is not pleasure at the end. No, indeed. This is the ultimate pain of the major punishment.
It locks in the Bene Gesserit lesson. But what will she do to those guards?
The words were wrenched from Duncan.
I cannot say what the specific elements of the individual punishments will be. I have no need to know. I can only tell you it will be different for each of them.
Tamerlane would say no more. She returned to laying out the next day's lessons.
We will continue tomorrow, she said, teaching you to identify the sources of the various accents of spoken Gaelic.
No one else, not even Teg or Patrin, would answer his questions about the punishments. Even the guards, when he saw them afterward, refused to speak of their ordeals. Some reacted curtly to his overtures, and none would play with him any more. There was no forgiveness among the punished. That much was clear.
Damn Shuangyu! Damn Shuangyu!
That was where his deep hatred of her began. All of the old witches shared in his hatred. Would the new young one be the same as the old ones?
Damn Shuangyu!
When he demanded of Shuangyu, "Why did you have to punish them?" Shuangyu took some time before answering. Then,
"It is dangerous for you here on Gamu. There are people who wish you harm."
Duncan did not ask why. This was another area where his questions were never answered. Not even Teg would answer, although Teg's very presence emphasized the fact of that danger. And Miles Teg was a mentat who must know many answers. Duncan often saw the old man's eyes glisten while his thoughts went far away. But there was no mentat response to such questions as, "Why are we here on Gamu? Who do you guard against? Who wants to harm me? Who are my parents?" Silence greeted such questions, or sometimes Teg would growl,
"I cannot answer you."
The library was useless. He had discovered this when he was only 8 and his chief instructor was a failed reverend mother named Loran Gyasa, not quite as ancient as Shuangyu, but well along in years. More than 100, anyway. At his demand, the library produced information about Gamu Gidi Prime, about the Harkonnens and their fall, about various conflicts where Teg had commanded. None of those battles came through as very bloody. Several commentators referred to Teg's superb diplomacy. But, one datum leading to another, Duncan learned about the time of the God Emperor and the taming of his people. This period commanded Duncan's attention for weeks. He found an old map in the records and projected it on the focus wall. The commentator's superimpositions told him that this very keep had been a fish speaker command center abandoned during the scattering.
Fish speakers!
Duncan wished then that he had lived during their time, serving as one of the rare male advisers in the female army that had worshipped the great god emperor.
Oh, to have lived on Rakis in those days!
Teg was surprisingly forthcoming about the God Emperor, calling him always the Tyrant. A library lock was opened, and information about Rakis came pouring out for Duncan.
"Will I ever see Rakis?" he asked Gyasa. "You are being prepared to live there."
The answer astonished him. Everything they taught him about that faraway planet came into new focus.
"Why will I live there?" "I cannot answer that."
With renewed interest, he'd returned to his studies of that mysterious planet and its miserable Church of Shai Hulud, the divided god. Worms. The god emperor had become those worms. The idea filled Duncan with awe. Perhaps here was something worthy of worship. The thought touched a chord in him. What had driven a man to accept that terrible metamorphosis? Duncan knew what his guards and the others in the keep thought about Rakis and the core of priesthood there. Sneering remarks and laughter told it all. Teg said,
"We'll probably never know the whole truth of it, but I tell you, lad, that's no religion for a soldier."
Shuangyu capped it.
"You are to learn about the tyrant, but you are not to believe in his religion. That is beneath you. Contemptible."
In every spare study moment, Duncan pored over whatever the library produced for him, the Holy Book of the Divided God, the Guard Bible, the Orange Catholic Bible, and even the Apocrypha. He learned about the long-defunct Bureau of the Faith and the pearl that is the Sun of Understanding. The very idea of the worms fascinated him. Their size, a big one would stretch from one end of the keep to the other. Men had ridden the pre-tyrant worms, but the Rakian priesthood forbade this now. He found himself gripped by accounts from the archaeological team that had found the tyrant's primitive no-chamber on Rakis. Daris Balat, the place was called. The reports by archaeologist Hadi Banoto were marked suppressed by orders of the Rakian priesthood. The file number on the accounts from the Bene Gesserit archives was a long one, and what Banoto revealed was fascinating.
"A kernel of the God Emperor's awareness in each worm?" he asked Gyasa.
"So it said. And even if true, they are not conscious, not aware. The tyrant himself said he would enter an endless dream."
Each study session occasioned a special lecture, and Bene Gesserit explanations of religion, until finally he encountered those accounts called the Nine Daughters of Siona and the Thousand Sons of Idaho. Confronting Gyasa, he demanded,
"My name is Duncan Idaho too. What does that mean?"
Gyasa always moved as though standing in the shadow of her failure, her long head bent forward and her watery eyes aimed at the ground. The confrontation occurred near evening in the long hall outside the practice floor. She paled at his question. When she did not answer, he demanded,
"Am I descended from Duncan Idaho?"
"You must ask Shuangyu."
Gyasa sounded as though the words pained her. It was a familiar response, and it angered him. She meant he would be told something to shut him up, little information in the telling. Shuangyu, however, was more open than expected.
"You carry the authentic blood of Duncan Idaho."
"Who are my parents?"
"They are long dead."
"How did they die?"
"I do not know. We received you as an orphan."
"Then why do people want to harm me?"
"They fear what you may do."
"What is it I may do?"
"Study your lessons. All will be made clear to you in time."
"Shut up and study." Another familiar answer. He obeyed because he had learned to recognize when the doors were closed on him, but now his questing intelligence met other accounts of the famine times and the scattering, the no chambers and no ships that could not be traced, not even by the most powerful, prescient minds in their universe. Here he encountered the fact that descendants of Duncan, Idaho, and Siona, those ancients who had served the tyrant god emperor, also were invisible to prophets and prescience. Not even a guild steersman deep in Melange trance could detect such people. Siona, the accounts told him, was a true-bred Atreides,